Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Literary Viewpoints with Fran Lewis, and we have an outstanding guest and an outstanding show today. His book is called Time to Try the Soul of Man. It's based on an actually real person, and he is a talk show host on All That Matters Radio. He's written a ton of books that I've read that are fantastic, and he's Kenneth Wien. How are you?
I am great. Thank you, Fran, asking, and thank you for having me on your show today.
I am thrilled to have you on my show today. You're one of my favorite authors. So would you tell everyone how you came to create this particular book and based on a real person, some of the background, so that everybody that's listening will want to buy 17 copies of it?
Okay. First off, let me explain that I'm a shrink by training. And So I had a friend, a young friend who had been a client, and he called me from South America. He was in Peru, and he was scheduled to take a trip up to Machu Picchu. And he called me up, and he said, Ken, I have a problem. He says, I've run into a bunch of Israelis, group of Israelis, and they want me to travel with them. They're telling me, you know, hey, we're going to camp. Come over, join us. And he says, I don't know, should I do it? And I said, well, you like them. Are you there for an adventure? They've been honest about who they are. Why not? I mean, I'd go. So, okay, great. He gets up about halfway to Machu Picchu, and I get another call. He says, Ken, what have I gotten into? And what are you talking about? Well, just they have guns in the back of the Jeep. They have guns. They have shortwave radios, all kinds of military stuff. So I said, hey, look, relax. You are probably the safest you will ever be in your life. You've been picked up by a Mossad training mission. And these guys are using you as their beard, and they will take care of you. Relax and have a good trip. Okay, fast forward, because it's really important to know that actually happened. Fast forward, and my friend has now come back to New York City. And he's attending college there. And he gets himself a job in a local newspaper, one of these, you know, out in the outer boroughs, the outer reaches of Queens newspapers. But he has dreams of becoming a newspaper man. He's living in the city, living down in what's called Alphabet City, which you, of course, being a New Yorker, you know where that is. And one morning, New York City, Alphabet City, his building starts to shake. He obviously runs out onto the streets. Oh, I should mention, he's got his girlfriend living with him. His girlfriend he's brought back from South America. So the two of them rush out into the street and to look around to find out what's going on. And what's going on is the gentrification of this part of New York, the Alphabet City area. Now, there's a little problem in Alphabet City. Unlike the rest of Manhattan, where you can build all these great skyscrapers because there's granite underneath, the Alphabet City is basically nothing but sand and old refuse. There's nothing down there. So when they start knocking down these old buildings, everything starts to topple over. The other thing is that when they start looking into this, when this young man starts looking into it to find out what's going on, he learns that there is a guy whose name actually was Armando Perez. And Armando Perez is quite an interesting character in himself because he started one of the early community centers down in Lower Manhattan, one of from the 70s and 80s, that period. And he was one of the founders of the fringe movement in New York, the artistic fringe movement. Well, Armando, running this community center in the middle of Alphabet City, And the people who are doing the, he's trying to stop this gentrification. He's going to the sites where they're knocking down buildings and protesting. And also, he's fighting to keep hold of his own community center, because the city wants to take it back and knock it down. Mm. So he's running the court and fighting this. Well, this is a pretty interesting story to this young reporter. And even though his beat is supposed to be out in the outer boroughs of Queens, the other town side of Queens, he keeps going back and going back to this well. Well, then things start getting a little bit really strange. Armando Perez is murdered. I don't want to tell too much of the story, the background and all, but he is murdered. And he is murdered out in Queens, out near where this young man is a reporter. The young man has gotten involved enough that he wants, and I'm going to call him Nick. It's not his real name, but that's the name I gave him in the book. And Nick gets involved in investigating and particularly gets upset when he learns that the police have arrested this bunch of kids who, no way are they the ones who murdered them, and the reason given makes no sense. Nothing makes any sense. And Nick goes, gets involved. The next thing he knows, he's getting death threats. And actually, at this point, the Mossad get back involved because they're walking around behind Nick. They're protecting him. One of the fellows from the Mossad has come to New York, and he is protecting Nick. Also protecting Nick, the Latin Kings, the street gang, because they love Armando, who in the book, by the way, I call Armando. I give him the name Jose. Armando has been a real supporter of you know, rehabilitation and return to community and all that wonderful stuff for the Latin Kings. So they love him. So they want to protect Nick. Well, they all go to a police meeting about the crime, you know, a community update, because people want to know what's happening with this case, especially after these kids have been released. And gosh, Nick and the other people who have heard the tape, because remember, we're back in the days of answering machines, and people have heard the tape of the death threat. And the cop who was giving the speech is the guy who had called in the death threat. Now, that's all reality-based. Okay, that's the real background of Times to Try the Soul of Man. So it's a scary, upsetting story about something going very, very wrong in our society. Now, I'm just going to throw you one more twist that comes along. Okay, this is all back before 9/11. And the reason why that particular Mossad agent is in New York fits right into our worst conspiracy theories and views of the world. He's there following somebody. He has been assigned by the Mossad to keep track of somebody. And again, this is part of the reality base of the story. The person that he is following lives right next to the Twin Towers. And that person is the daughter of Osama bin Laden. People, you know, never realized that he bin Laden had daughters as well as sons, and that he was not in any way above using those girls as part of his operations. And so Mo, the Mossad agent, has been assigned to follow the bin Laden daughter just before 9/10. Okay. And again, this is part of the reality base of the story. 9:10, Mo calls Nick, and he says, forget everything else that's going on, forget Jose Armando, forget all of that stuff, just something bad is coming down in Manhattan. He says, do not go to Manhattan tomorrow. He says, I don't know what it is. He says, I just know something bad is going to happen. I have called the CIA. You are the only other call I am making. I'm breaking protocol and calling you. Because he knew that Nick knew that he was inside. I'm breaking protocol. I'm calling you. Don't go down there. We don't know what's going to happen. He says, but I know something is going to happen. And then he kind of lets loose something else. He says, I called the CIA, my counterpart, but I think they already knew.
That's what most people think, too.
Yeah. So, anyway, Bin Laden's daughter has fled. That's what Mo tells Nick. Bin Laden's daughter has fled. And he, Mo, is following her. She's left the country already. And he's following her. And that's how he knows that something, because, you know, the fact that she's out without any notice is what's saying to him. That's what he's saying. Okay, wow. Something bad is happening. Well, that's the reality base behind this story. I won't go into all the political characters and all of the machinations. There's a lot more truth in the book that I don't want to go in. But I'm going to tell you one interesting little fact that I just learned, because I am still friends with the fellow who was Nick in the book.
Oh, nice.
We're good friends. Yeah, and he called me the other day, and we were chatting, and he said, oh, by the way, Ken, I just learned something about somebody that I never realized was important in the story. And I said, what's that? He said, well, you know, that borough, that police precinct out where all of this was taking place, that was, you know, way out in the boonies. He said, the captain of that precinct, I never thought anything about him because it was like the least important precinct in all of Manhattan. In all of New York City. The guy was considered a nothing. But, you know, the other day I sat down and I started Googling names. And I, for no better reason, I put his name in. And, you know, he retired about a year later. And he immediately became one of the major officers in one of the largest security firms. Not security as an investment, but security as police protection type security in the world. He says, all of a sudden, this guy went from being the bottom of the barrel in Queens
to somebody else.
You know, to somebody very important. What do you make of them? I just laughed because, you know, it always occurred to me that Nick never really appreciated the full extent of what he had stumbled into. So anyway, that's the reality base, and it's quite a story. I mean, just it's history and it's the events that people live through. Very scary and upsetting, especially to those of us who love New York City.
For those of us who love people in the Twin Towers, yeah. You know, it's funny, you were talking about gentrification. My cousin lives in an area which was gentrified in Manhattan. And there's a lot of, he's moving, actually, finally. He said there are a lot of people that won't go there. There are a lot of people that don't feel safe there. There are a lot of people that do feel safe there. I haven't seen it, but my cousin was there. And she said it's beautiful, but there's a lot of controversy over it. But Nick is a freelance reporter. And
no, not freelance. He's working for a
company. Yeah,
he's working for a little local. His job is basically he's supposed to do things like reporting little league games.
But didn't he work for somebody first where they said his articles were no good and that he couldn't write them? That he was submitting them.
That's his little local. place. And they're basically saying to him, not that he can't write so much as...
Gets like his topics.
This isn't what we want. This isn't what we want. We want to know about the ladies' tea at the library. This is a local.
How boring.
He's trying to make it a Pulitzer. That's his goal, a Pulitzer.
That's what he wants, the poor guy. What can I say? We all want something, recognition, but we don't
right.
always get it. Okay,
right.
So there's other characters in the book that we can hopefully talk about, and these are all the girls in his life. Melinda, Michelle, and Sue. And this guy gets around, and he seems like a guy that can't find himself, that he's got issues with his own identity, and he keeps looking for somebody that's going to actually care about him.
Yes. Actually, there's another woman two other women we ought to mention. Estella, who very minor character, but very important because toward the end of the book, he begins, and as he's writing this, because it's a memoir, of course, it's written as a memoir, and as he's writing the book, he realizes that was his big mistake. He went after the superficialities of relationships and beauty and such instead of going after
something deep. He really hurt her.
Yeah.
I know.
The other woman... who is very central in his life and is his mother. And his mother had run off she had a whole series of relationships that she kept falling in love. And he came from a very bad marriage. I mean, this is the fiction. I'm writing fiction here. But I wanted to make the book both a story of a personal journey as well as tying it to the exploration of what we as a country are. So I wanted to integrate those two aspects. So, he goes looking for women, and basically Marcy is the girl he brings back instead of Estella, whom would have made a wonderful match for him, and probably he would have settled down right away. But instead he goes after this girl, Marcy, who is not a bad girl. In fact, she is based on the real-life young woman that he brought back from South America, whom I did meet. And she was very sweet, very loving, but very clinging. And there was no way, he was going to get involved with somebody who was going to hang on to him that way at that point in his life. He was not ready for that. So he dumped her, basically. She went back to South America. And then he meets one of the women at the community center that Jose is running, and he gets very involved with her, and he gets very possessive and jealous of and obsessed with her. And then when that falls apart, he meets basically a sex worker. Her name is Sue. And Sue is a erotic dancer who's kind of at the bottom of the thing. Now, in the book, I kind of did only hint at it. I've been working with a very fine script writer. We've been working on adapting the book. And in the book, in the movie version, we're going to make it much clearer that Sue has been working for Mo, the Mossad agent, all along.
Oh, wow.
Sue shows up at a desperate time in Nick's life. And he gets very obsessed with her. Then, on 9/11, she shows up again. Now, he of course, being who he is, there's no way he has taken Mo's advice. And he ends up not down at the Twin Towers, but at Houston Street, which is a major cross street in lower Manhattan. And the police, he goes the other way when everybody else does. But he is there you know, and he sees from a distance some of the horror. He sees people running. He and in that moment of terror and horror, he is again meets Sue. Now, again, in the movie version, what we're working toward is to have people realize that this is engineered. But in the book, it just seems more spontaneous. But he ends up with Sue, and he realizes that he really cares about her. And he's going to take off. Mo has told him, get out of town. And in fact, the Mossad agent, real-life Mossad agent, the real Mo, had told him to get out of town. So he gets. But Sue goes with him. And so in that sense, he has made a journey from being this guy who couldn't commit and who was taking the most superficial of things. And now he turns to this woman who really is not just a superficial woman. She is, for all the fact that she is a sex worker and, you know, how she earns a living, is really a very deep and caring character. And the two of them end up, and I don't want to go beyond that because that explains more.
You can't tell anybody because there are people listening and we don't want them to know. But there is another character that we didn't mention. Every time he seems to get in financial straits, he goes to his father. What does his father always seem to be in his corner despite everything? I mean, he's lucky. He doesn't ask any questions. And for some reason, he's always there. Why is that?
Well, if you think about coming from that kind of a family background where mom has taken off, and at least in part, mom's justification for taking off is her belief that dad has been cheating. There's a lot of parental guilt there. And the other thing is, it happens that dad is fairly successful. He's got money. So it's easy to give, you know, if you have a lot of money, it's easy to give your kid money and support him that way. It's not a deep and abiding kind of relationship in the way that, you know, you might want for a young man, for example. Although the father does go down to South America and spend some time with him on Easter Island, but you never get the sense and that this is like more than a kind of guilt-driven father. He wants to do right. He feels bad for what happened to his kid. But, you know, so it's easy to throw money when you have it.
That's very true. But there are a lot of parents out there that enable their kids and don't give them a responsibility of having to take care of themselves. And then there are some that feel guilty, so they do it anyway. Been there, done it, know it.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's interesting because he has a brother, and although the brother doesn't play much in the book, except to give him a little more depth, the family a little more depth. But you know, one of the things about Nick. And this is a very, you know, it's very hard for some people to say, he's a good guy. And his father knows that. Nick is not scummy. Some of his values are. The way he relates to women
really
honest. Yeah. But when you think about what he's gone through and his familial trauma and all of those things, he's really kind of this kind of sad guy and his father feels guilty. And in the end, he redeems himself, which brings us up to another theme in the book. This is a book about God. And, you know, it's very easy for people to miss that because I do try and write my books at a story level first, and these other more underlying themes. But in my mind, almost every book I write has to in some way include my notions about God and about the universe. It just kind of built into me. I can't avoid it.
That's true.
And so one of the things that goes on is what happens to him at Machu Picchu.
And that was my next question.
He has a revelation up there. He hears the voice of God. And that, it may be altitude sickness. It may be that he was just sick, that he picked up a virus and he had a fever. It may be any of a lot of things. But the reality for him is that he, in his mind, is he's heard the voice of God. And this comes echoing back at the end of the book. What does it mean to have heard the voice of God? And if we don't understand what that means in our lives, because I think every one of us has an opportunity in our lives to hear the divine voice. And if we don't understand what that calls us to do, then we've missed it. We've missed life. And I think that for Nick, the very great redemption of Nick as a character is that he hears the voice of God, and in the end, he knows what that means in his life.
Well, I have an unusual question for you. Two of them. Ready?
Sure.
Off the top of my head as I'm writing. Number one, how did you decide on the chapter headings for this book, because each one of them sort of tells its own story? And how does the real Nick feel about this book?
Okay. The chapter headings. Because I see each chapter pretty much as having its own little storyline and a continuum.
Yeah.
I like giving that kind of title, so people can see it as a story. And the people have read other of my books, particularly Tales from the Dewdrop Inn, which, of course, you were kind enough to have.
I love that one. That was great.
Yeah. Well, again, each story stood alone. Well, in that case, much more than alone. But my feeling is that if you're writing a book in which the chapters can stand alone, it's nice to give people something to kind of reference back to them with. I tend to see the chapters for this book more as being something people can reference back to and say, oh, yeah, in that chapter. Nick Love, he likes the book. He understands what part is fiction and what part is nonfiction. He understands that what I was trying to do in creating him was to create that struggle with finding meaning and purpose in his life, as opposed to just, telling his biography. It's not a biography. So he understands that. He likes very much the way I have portrayed the newspaper. And he, of course, to this day, he still mourns Armando, whom I call him. He considers him one of the truly great people he has met, and he really likes the way I have presented him in the book a lot.
Yeah, it was sad, and it was a box of tissues, people. It seriously was.
Yeah.
Because it comes at you and you don't really think that that's going to happen. And, of course, with you it's a twist, so that made it even better. I said, okay, now he's got me on this one. That's not fair. But I don't know about in real life, but in this story, Nick has a habit of resorting to drugs and beer to escape reality. Why does he feel that that's necessary in order to deal with life or not deal with life?
Well, in large part, he's a creature of the place he grew up. Long Island at that time, that was pretty typical teen behavior. And he doesn't have a real rudder. you know, there is this tremendous sense of loss that he has, that one of the secrets here of the book and understanding the book, and I try and layer it in very subtly, is he was very, very close to his mother. Very, very hurt by her leaving.
When she left, yeah.
And he didn't really know how to cope with that. And then, you know, he gets into a school situation that really, in some ways, is just so totally unconnected to his needs. I think one of the things that's very formative in the book, in the character in the book, is he wants to find something to excel at. And the thing he really wants to do is be on the school newspaper. And, you know, he wants to make it in a meaningful way. He wants to do something meaningful.
Mm.
And the school won't let him. And they won't let him because they're watching their own rumps. And in a sense, that's a precursor to what goes on with the police department. And then what goes on in another level with the whole government as the story evolves. You know, we don't want anybody really reporting on reality. So being a kid, being a teenager, having nothing to fall back on and feeling that his great potential to be a reporter, and he really believes he can be a reporter. You know, I mean, he wants that Pulitzer. The same way another kid might want to make it to the Yankees. He wants, you know, he wants to make it to the Times. And,
don't blame him.
And the school is saying to him, well, you know, we don't want you to talk about this reality. And when you take away reality, I'm a shrink. I mentioned that going in. And one of the things is, you know, we use in shrink language, we talk about repression. Well, repression is, you know, Freud talked about it as being unconscious. I see it as much more conscious. I think repression is when we're told, as kids, you can't talk about that. You're not supposed to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he experiences repression there. Because he's older, he doesn't bury it, but he is very aware of it. And repression leads to acting out and to neurosis. And, you know, he is a flawed character. Very flawed.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like censorship, you might say.
That
I know. That's sad, because that's what I meant at the beginning of the interview when I said his topics weren't allowed. They didn't want him to. They didn't write it. So how would you describe the primary topics of your novel? And what would you say each, we've got Sue, we've got Nick, we've got quite a few characters. Why did you create characters that are truly flawed? Does that make them more believable? Because anybody that creates characters that are too perfect, you begin to wonder if they're really real.
Well, certainly I wanted flawed characters because I wanted real characters. But also, and of course, you know, we do have two really, really outstandingly unflawed characters. We have Jose.
Yeah.
And we have Maria, his wife. By the way, I have met the real wife, and she really is as warm, sweet, loving, and caring as I try and portray her in the book. I also met a secretary, Helen, who was very devoted, and I met Helen, the real Helen, and she also was as devoted. So I didn't want to have more perfect people. I mean, there were enough of that. But I also, you know, I am writing about redemption. I am writing about the human journey. I am writing about a man who hears the voice of God and eventually understands what that means. And in Sue, I am writing about a woman who embodies, as does Stella, embodies a capacity to love. And that is a redeeming quality. So I believe that if you do not have flaws, you do not have redemption. The only one of my characters that I think I have ever written about where I didn't see them starting out as a flawed character is Mary in Widow's Walk.
I love that book.
I know you did. And of course, she ends up very badly.
Yeah, I know. And that was another box of tissues.
Yes, but I mean, you know, there are a lot of boxes of tissues in my life. But, you know,
yeah, I know. I've been using a lot of them lately.
Yeah, but I don't, my goal is not to produce perfect characters, you know, icons of perfection, but rather to produce characters that are going to be real. And yeah, you know, how many times when I'm writing a novel does it come to me and I want to scream at a character? I just want to say, don't do it, you idiot. Let them do it anyway.
Well, sometimes they just don't listen and they run your life, whatever. But
right,
do you see that Nick will ever find peace with himself in real life and in the book?
Okay, let me answer that for the real person. Okay,
yeah.
The real person, okay, what actually has ended up, okay, Nick, the real person, Nick, is now in business. He did leave the newspaper game to go into the family business, and he loves it and is extraordinarily successful at it. He's married. He's married.
Oh, nice.
He has a stepdaughter who is actually, interestingly enough, his stepdaughter and Ron's, my wife, are very, very close. She's
nice.
Only like about 13, but she and Ron's just have this wonderful connection. And then he has three other children that he and his wife have had together. And they are, well, I don't know the littlest one that well yet, but the two I do know well, plus the stepdaughter, the three I know, are just delightful children, and he has a wonderful time with them, and just is trying to be the best possible dad.
That's great.
And yeah, he really is, he's turned into a really very nice human being, a very caring human being, and as I say, he has stayed very close to myself and to my wife, and I think if you asked my wife, she would say he is probably one of the most changed people over the course of his life from when I first met him to what he is today that she has ever run across in her life.
Do you think the book helped?
Reading the book, I don't think.
No,
the
writing
book
the book.
Did telling me the story in my writing the book help him?
Yes.
Yes, I think it did. I think it actually did.
Yeah.
I think it helped him to see meaning and value in a very painful and traumatic experience. Yeah.
That is great. Before I forget, because I don't want to forget. I don't forget anything. My husband hates that. I forget nothing. I could tell you what he wore the first time I went out with him 18 years ago and what he ate for lunch, you know, every single day. He hates when I do that, but it's okay. On October 8th, the author of Enemy in the Heartland, really, bioterrorism, all sorts of terrorist attacks, and about 2,000 characters in the book, and I was really proud of myself that I was able to keep up with all of them. He's really good. Stephen Schwarzerly will be here.
Oh, cool.
On Stephen Schwartzley, I think his name is. Enemy in the Heartland.
Cool, not who.
Cool, cool. Oh, okay. I forgot him too. On 10/15, New York Times best-selling author, internationally famous author of Strong Light of Day, John Land, takes center stage. And that book was fantastic. And I have been honored, Ken, to do a special tribute to the memory of one of my favorite icons, Elizabeth Montgomery, and the 50-year celebration of Bewitched with the creator of classic TV, Herbie Pilato, is going to take center stage at 10 o'clock on 10/29. He asked me to personally do this, and I did a personal tribute on my WordPress review site to Elizabeth Montgomery and Rebecca Asher, the daughter. I thought it was wonderful, so that made me feel really great. And on November 5th, I can't believe the show's booked till the end of November, Tanya Kappas, New York Times bestselling author, Ghostly Murder, interesting. And on November 10th, New York Times bestselling author, Alan Jacobson, The Lost Codex. On the 18th, Mike Bond, Killing Maine. And on the 19th, mystery writer, thriller writer, Brian Freeman has taken into writing romance novels, West 57th. And that's just some. There's more, I'm sure, somewhere. And
Wow. Tell
me something. What is next? Are you going to bring Nick back in another book?
Well, first of all, let me just say, you just made me feel really wonderful to know that I am in such great company on your show. But then I've
you
always
are,
wondered,
and I don't know. I only pick the best and most wonderful authors. Let me tell you, I'm really fussy.
I know you are. Nick coming back. It is a possibility. The book I'm working on right now, and it has become a monumental book to write. It's Dickensian in both its plot twists and in its length. It's about the Native American experience at the end of the 19th century. And
its
tentative title is Red and White, and obviously that predates Nick. That's something really very special I've been working on for some time. The thing that makes it so special is that interspersed within it are Native American myths and traditions. But I'm not using established myths and traditions. I'm writing new ones, but I'm doing it as close to the Native American format and structure and voice as I can. So what I'm doing is I have some Native American very good friends, including one of the staff at the Heard Museum here in Phoenix. I have a very good friend who's an Apache, Chiricahua Apache, people like that. And I keep having them look at and hear to see, not if I'm necessarily dead on in, oh, yeah, that's what we believe, but rather, you're dead on in that's how we believe. That's how
that's
we
good.
Can. Yeah. And so it's really a work of love. And that's the next thing. And meanwhile, of course, as I mentioned, I'm having this wonderful time working on a film script for Times. And so those are the two things I'm current writing. But will I bring Nick back? Yeah, I think probably I will bring back Nick, even though it will obviously not be his life anymore, based on the real person anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think he's a great character.
Yeah, he is. He's interesting. That's why I asked.
Yeah, and I think he might go on to do something else in the investigative reporting field. In fact, while I mentioned that the real life Nick is now no longer in reporting, he did leave New York and he came out to the rest of the country. Let me just say that, because I don't want to give too many clues who he is.
No.
But he did do some reporting, and some of the reporting he did when in one place was actually pretty heavy-duty investigative stuff, and he found some real political, it's called boondoggling, where mm-hmm. where people made a lot of money cheating us things. So, you know, yeah, I certainly could see him coming back and telling us another story about his life.
Well, I
think
just want
I would
you
to
know,
to write it.
When you write when the movie comes out, I want mm-hmm. I want the premiere to be in New York so I could be in the front seat. In Radio City Music Hall, because yes, I mean, mm-hmm. first of all, I'm very excited to say that I won't say which author, and I won't say the title of the book, but she made me the villain. I was so happy. So when this mm-hmm. book comes out, I'm going to help her promote it because I am the bad character in the book, and they're using my real name. I can't believe it. Yeah, I got excited.
How on earth
I said,
did somebody make anything bad about you? You're such
I have
a
no idea.
Being.
She decided that I was going to be the villain, and I haven't read the book yet to see what she how horrible I am. She said I'm not nice, and I don't know if I'm the killer or if I help the killer or whatever. But I know I don't know if I'm. I think I'm a book reviewer or writer or somebody, and they don't like me. And what could I say? I try to be so nice, so. What can I tell you? I guess I'm going to have to wait and see what she does. But where can everybody get to know more about you and your book? And just remember, if Red and White is about Indians, whatever, it's going to take me a while to read it, but I will read it. No problem. I get it all. So where can everybody learn more about you?
I have a website, and it's very easy because it's my name, Kenneth Wien. And my last name is spelled W-E-E-N-E. So you just go to www.kennethween.com. And, of course, they can find my books most easily on Amazon. And if they just, again, look under my name. And you mentioned the radio show I co-host, which is on Thursday
yes,
night.
Yes, tell everybody.
We don't do that many books. I mean, we leave the great book reviewing to you. We do some.
Thanks.
But more often what we're doing, even if it's a book, is a really interesting kind of topic. Like last week we were discussing helping veterans to write and you get over PTSD using writing.
That's
this
great.
This
yeah.
week, which is actually, the show is 9 o'clock in New York time. And it's on the internet, and it's called It Matters Radio. And this evening at 9 o'clock your time, I'm talking to Mary Lee Esty, who is a neuropsychologist, and her specialty is neurological biofeedback.
And, you know what? You're going to have to send me the link to that because I definitely want to hear it, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And I think you could figure out why. I'm not going to tell everybody why, but yeah, I definitely, definitely have to listen to that as something that I need to learn about, seriously.
And just to give you an idea of the scope, I'm going to just mention one more topic because next week I have the Crayon Initiative coming in. How often do you go to a restaurant and you see them bring, like, kids? Or if you know somebody like my wife, they bring my wife crayons to color
Me
with.
Too. Yeah.
And then what happens to those crayons afterwards?
Don't they take them home?
No, most kids don't.
They should.
No, I know, but they don't, so they get wasted. Well, the Crayon Initiative has come up with this absolutely wonderful answer to that question. And it is one of the nicest, sweetest stories that I have found. So anyway, it's called It Matters Radio. And you can look at we have our own website, www.itmattersradio.com. And we're at 9 o'clock Eastern time on the internet. And we do music and then great topics. And then I have to give one more plug. I'm sorry, but one more plug.
Go ahead. Be my guest.
To something that Fran belongs to as well as I. I'm one of the founding editors of something called the Right Room Blog. And you look for it that
great.
Way, www.theright.com. And we have a group of 30-some authors who worked together, marketing. Instead of just having one blog, we have this group blog, so we have sometimes joint topics, sometimes individual, but a variety, and it's very interesting. Some great reading. Right now, I think we have a romance thing up, which
Joey,
I really enjoyed.
I sent Delaney my music thing.
Right, you said, right, we have the music thing.
I did.
Thing
I sent her the music thing because it took me forever to write 500 words. With me, you know, I could write 10,000 words. But I was a music
right.
major, but I didn't. That story about my sister and I and singing in front of all those people, that really happened. I didn't make that up, seriously.
I'm sure.
I didn't. And I was really pleased that people thought it was hilarious because who in their right mind would get up in front of a group of people and sing what I did and make a program that no one would ever think, you know, what could I say? I can't sing. And I did get a B-plus in the class, and I got another B-plus not to take the second one because I got all A's in my music classes, and I was a concert violinist and concert pianist, but I couldn't sing even – I even sang Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star that day off-key, but, you know, nobody cared because – I had guts to get up and do it. What can I say? So before we go, one last question.
Wait a second. Before we stop, I got to tell people, if you're interested in what Fran wrote and you want to hear it, guys, that will be up in the Right Room blog on October 14th.
Oh yes, that's if everybody likes what I wrote about music and whatever.
Right.
I find that when I get upset about a lot of other things, if I stick on Pavarotti or classical music or anything that's soothing, it just makes you feel a whole lot better. And it works for me. Music is like the best soother and the best stress reliever in the entire world. So anything that you listen to that makes you, you know, close your eyes and feel better rather than doing other things that you shouldn't do. I think when I was 190 pounds a few years ago, I think I was getting aggravated, so I was eating. I don't do that anymore. I'm like 106 pounds, and it works for me, let me tell you. I look 30 years younger. It's great to walk into a room, and they have them ask you for your driver's license when you're giving them your insurance cards, and they don't believe you. It's hilarious. It's totally hilarious. So, Ken, I want to thank you so very much. And if your show was earlier than 9 o'clock, I would be able to listen to it, but by that time, forget it.
I do want the link.
It
is available on podcast, yes.
I am going to, you have to send me the link because biofeedback is something that I want to learn how to deal with for my, you know, one of my lovely issues that I don't want to think about. What can I say?
Okay.
But I hope I get the next book, and I hope that
you
come join me again on my show. And maybe someday you'll do a show earlier so I could be on it. And by the way, everybody, sometimes it's not books. Sometimes we do speak out about an issue. So if anybody has a sports issue, if anybody wants to talk about Common Core or anything that's interesting in music, art, fashion, and wants to do a show, let me know because this is MJ Network and it's Fran's Network and I could do whatever I want, which is really cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it is. You know what? I went out on my own. I'm going to do some shows on World of Ink with Marcia Casper Cook and Virginia Grenier because they're great friends, but I find that I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. And look forward, people. Catherine Coulter is waiting for me to discuss when we're going to do a show on The Endgame, which happens to be my pick of the month. And on October 26th, New York Times bestselling author Simon Chavez, Thin Black Line. Let's hope he gets through from Canada this time. And on that note, Ken, I want to thank you so very much. And everybody, the sun is shining. It's beautiful outside. It's 60 degrees. Go out and take a walk because that's what I'm going to do before I go to the dentist. Thanks a lot, Ken, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.